Another warning on global climate change, this time from the World Meteorological Organization. It says frightening trends have been spotted, but who's to blame? And can anything be done to reverse them? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Imran Khan. The state of the global climate is alarming, to say the least. That's according to a report by the UN's WMO. It says people on every continent are being affected after many records linked to climate change were broken last year. They included those on rainfall in Pakistan, heat waves in China and Europe, and ocean temperatures also reached record highs, with nearly 60% suffering at least one marine heat wave. The report says trying to save the glaciers is a lost cause, underlying the irreversible nature of climate trends on our planet. We'll go to our guests in a moment, but first, this report.
A year of extremes. The UN says 2022 saw sea levels and ocean heat reach record levels. And it described those for the melting of some glaciers in Europe as off the charts. In its annual global climate report, the World Meteorological Organization says Antarctic sea ice fell to its lowest extent ever recorded. Adds to a final warning last month issued by the UN's climate body, the IPCC, that time is running out for the world.
We have already lost this melting of glaciers game and sea level rise game. So that's bad news. And according to IPCC, the conservative estimate of sea level rise is half meter to 1 meter per century.
This is all part of what the UN describes as, quote, planetary scale changes on land, in the ocean and in the atmosphere. In Europe, the report says at least 15,000 people died last year due to intense heat waves. And in Africa, more than 1.7 million people in Somalia and Ethiopia were displaced from their homes by drought. At the other extreme, flooding devastated Pakistan, leaving about a third of the nation submerged and 8 million people displaced. The report also warns more extreme weather could be seen as soon as next year if no action is taken to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
We need accelerated action in three areas. First, net zero deadlines. My proposal is for leaders of developed countries to commit to reaching net zero as close as possible to 2040, the limit you should all aim to respect. And for leaders of emerging economies to commit to reaching net zero as close as possible to 2050.
The developing world is suffering disproportionately from climate disasters, and so far, only a few nations are on track to meet their climate goals. And according to the UN, to avert disaster, nations must adapt quickly to a warming planet, or it'll be too late. Alex Katopoulos for Inside Story.
Let's go now to our guests. Joining me in Eemnes, Netherlands, is Leon Simons. He's a climate researcher in New York. David Holland, he's a professor of mathematics and atmosphere ocean science in the Courant Institute at New York University, Abu Dhabi. And in Texas, Andrew Kruchkovich, senior researcher at Columbia University's Climate School. A warm welcome to you all. I'd like to begin in Texas first with Andrew Kruchkovich. Andrew, we've been talking for so long now about climate change, but it's not climate change anymore. It's climate changed. And surely this terminology is part of the problem. We're looking at now terminology that should suggest climate damage control, climate damage limitation, and proposing radical solutions now. We're past the point of no return, surely.
Well, what we're really talking about is understanding the disproportionality of impact of climate and climate change on different populations, on different industries, and at different times. We're starting to see even more of this disproportionality. What I mean by that is, yes, we're seeing extreme events, and we have the data to document that and to understand the trends. But we need to get better at understanding who is impacted, to what extent, and then understand to what extent we could make early warnings and especially early action to mitigate impact on the most underserved populations and the industries that are most critical. We've seen that in New York, we've seen that in Texas, we've seen that all over the world. So that's what we need to move more towards.
Leon, would you agree with that? Would you agree that if there are people that are being more affected, perhaps, than others, and we need early warning systems?
Yes, we need early warning systems, and we need to know when, where change will happen. And that's one important aspect of that is the emissions of sulfur. And we now see that there's a rapid reduction in sulfur emissions globally, which means that, especially in Northern Hemisphere latitude, we will see a lot of change happening very soon. And we need to be warned about it. And the World Meteorological Organization mentions that we need warning systems about droughts, about floods, about fires, and about sea level rise. But the important aspect of what causes these changes should also be mentioned.
But in order to actually figure out this, it is the root causes of the problem. David Holland in New York. David, we've been talking about this now for, what, 30 years, at least taking it very seriously. There have been micro-agreements that have taken place. The UN has put out its recommendations. Several other organisations have said, let's do this, let's do this. But none of those have actually happened. Reducing the temperature of the planet, one of the things that we tried to do, that hasn't actually happened. There is no way that the world can come together in the way that it needs to, surely.
I think that was probably true 5 years ago. It takes a while for things to move from the groundswell, if you will, to what's actually happening. And what I mean by that, for example, if you take the United States, the goal that the president set out by 2030 or so to have a certain decrease in carbonization, we are already halfway there. Or close to it. So remarkable change is actually happening now, and that's being caused by people, the will of people to want to preserve the planet and protect it. So change is actually happening, and I think we're going to see that reflected in the next few years.
Andrew, is that an optimistic assessment, do you think, from David?
Yes, I do think it's an optimistic assessment, and I think the questions that come to my mind are related to change. Change for who? I mean, this is an opportunity trying to correct what has been happening over the past 30 years and longer. It's we have a responsibility to prioritize underserved populations, systematically deprioritize populations and communities. And to me, that's really how we have to measure progress. Sure, we are making some progress, as noted, in some industries, in some areas of the world, but if we are to use this transition to a more sustainable way of living and a more sustainable way of living on Earth, we need to do a better job at prioritizing the communities that are usually and traditionally underserved and deprioritized.
Leon, would you agree with that? It's not about a global impact at the moment. It's not about global strategy, but we need to identify the communities most affected.
Yes, for sure. And to go back to the point before, I don't really see the progress. Of course, there's some steps being taken, but the past 3 years have been the three highest levels of CO2 emissions. We see the highest level of methane growth in the atmosphere for the past 3 years running, which means that we see more and more warming. As instead, the climate models which show a low scenario warming, there the methane concentration should be going down. Instead, they've been going rapidly, rapidly high up. And as mentioned before, the concentration of sulfur is rapidly decreasing, and sulfur has been hiding half degree of global warming. And now when we're decreasing sulfur emissions and not decreasing, let alone increasing the greenhouse gas emissions, we see a rapid increase in warming. The past 20 years, the rate of warming of the atmosphere was four times as it was between 1960 and 2000. So I don't see that much progress as we would need to really reduce the risks, especially in developing countries in regions which are more at risk. For example, India, which saw 50 degree temperatures last year, which will experience much more like that. Well, the monsoon region will change. We need to be aware of this. We need to be educated about this. Otherwise, we cannot adjust and let alone mitigate these risks.
I mean, David Holland, you did give us a fairly optimistic assessment, certainly more optimistic than maybe I've heard on this show in the past, but you've heard our two other guests there. What is driving your thinking then? Why do you think that we are on the right path?
So I live in New York City. New York State and New York City have ambitious plans to decarbonize within the next decade or two. New York City's electricity grid is already something like a quarter of the way there. I see this change happening in terms of New York City. The largest coal-providing plant powering this city is being converted to a hydroelectric plant, to renewable resources. I just see that there's a groundswell happening now where people are taking this problem really serious because of what the other two guests are saying. This, what they're saying is really sinking in, and I'm seeing the serious motivation. No longer is this a side issue. This is foremost on people's minds, and big changes are happening.
But, David, it is happening in industrialized countries. This isn't happening in Iraq, for example. It isn't happening in Pakistan, in places that are really affected by climate change. I know you touched on this, Andrew, just earlier, that we need to focus on those communities as well, those places. But you can't go in and force people to make radical changes, particularly when there are economic considerations involved. Some of the most poorest places on the planet are the most affected, Pakistan for one. How do you do that? How do you get them to change?
So I think it's a combination. To address the first part of the question and build off what David Holland was saying, I mean, yes, in New York, it's a good example of making progress at the city and the state level. And we're seeing that in different places in the United States, in many developed countries, and in other countries as well. However, we must remember that we are seeing extreme weather events that are leading to greater impact in some communities, even within the most developed countries. New York City, we had devastating flash floods a couple of years ago that led to over 20 to 30 deaths. And all of those deaths happened in New York City, in areas that are the lowest income areas in the city. So it speaks to the point of what David is saying. Can we have both? Can we be making good progress and also still potentially have some areas where we need to focus on the most extreme, let's say, tails of the distribution in terms of the socioeconomic factors that go into, in this case, what a disaster really is. What are the different ingredients of a disaster, for example? So I think that's important to say. Now, in other countries, yes, I think this is something that we must keep in mind. We've seen with the climate negotiations, forcing anyone, a country, an industry to change hasn't really worked so well. Now, in the U.S., for example, we are seeing more of a culture shift. You know, it's more of a social shift towards making these changes. It's generational in some ways, so that does give me hope. It gives me hope in the U.S. It also gives me hope in other areas of the world. We will see this generational shift hopefully lead to pressure to have more better policy for the environment and for the climate. And this is also something that came up in the WMO report. I think they did a good job at highlighting ecosystems and environment within a climate report. And this is pretty new. We haven't really seen that so much. So these different factors do give me hope. However, it is important to understand the difference between most of the populations, most of the communities, and then also the most underserved, the tails of the distribution. Perhaps we will need different approaches and different strategies for these different segments of the population.
Actually, Leon, Andrew makes a very good point here. There is a generational shift happening. There's a younger generation, and perhaps more environmentally aware than possibly any generation before this. Now, let's remember that all of this climate changed, has come from, you know, the Industrial Revolution and has come from capitalism. That's, you know, it's the drive for profits that has seen us wreck our planet. And this generation has noticed that, and they're much more talking about sustainability and things like that. But is this all just lip service? What's the practical that needs to be done, Leon?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of lip service, of course, and I think it's well meant. I think people really think we can change and we should change and are trying to. But just look at what happened in Europe last year. 15,000 people died from heat waves in the summer. 15,000 people. That's 10 times as many people as died in the floods in Pakistan. It barely made headlines. And still people are talking about shutting down nuclear power plants. They are keep the power plants of lignite coal plants in Germany running for 15 years. Of course, there's some talks about goals about 2050 or 2030 or whatever, but we don't see the reduction in emission changes. We see the concentration of methane going through the roof. We see the concentration of CO2 just keeps rising. We see the sulfur emissions declining. So we see rapid increase in warming, four times as fast as between 1960 and 2000. The atmosphere is warming now, and there's a lot of heat being accumulating in the system. And that's now with the El Nino, it's being released. Yes, we need changes. For example, I'm not against capitalism. I'm an entrepreneur, social entrepreneur. I work in, for example, in Ethiopia, a country with 110 million people, which are underserved. They still use wood for cooking, just like 2.5 billion people around the world. And sustainable cooking solutions are solutions for those people, and they can pay if they are willing to pay for that. They now pay for food. They now pay for fuel. So if there's a business case and you can reduce those costs and again save the environment and make a more sustainable environment for the people as well, there are solutions which also work together with capitalism. So I don't think we should throw away the systems we have, but we should be aware of the changes that are happening, the causes, which are a record increase in greenhouse gases and decreasing sulfur emissions, which were cooling the planet. And those will have the most effect, especially in warm regions, especially in the regions in the Northern Hemisphere where many of us live. And we need to speed up the changes in practice and not make nice goals for 2050.
David, I'm going to come to you in just a second. I want to put the point to Andrew up in Texas. Andrew, we have long demanded infinite growth from a planet with finite resources. That's the bottom line of capitalism. That's why we're where we are. Now, our guest in the Netherlands, Leon, is saying that actually there is sustainable capitalism. There is a cute and cuddly version of capitalism that might help us solve the planet, solve the environmental crisis. What do you make of that?
Yes, I mean, I think I would have to learn more about the definitions of that and what the motivating factors are. Like, that is definitely not my area of expertise, but I'm interested in learning about what the different definitions could look like or what the definition looks like. And then also how is it different? I mean, something we're seeing in the climate world, very broadly speaking, is we're seeing new terms and new ways to refer to things. And yeah, I think the private sector, not only the private sector, governments as well, are getting very good at using some of these terminologies. So I just think being specific about what that means, then perhaps I could comment on it. But something I can say is, with capitalism, what have we seen in terms of the lowest income populations, in terms of them having equal access to the resources, at least at a proportional level? And how would that change if we have sustainable capitalism? So those are some of the types of questions or thoughts that I have. But again, I would need to know more about the specifics.
Let me put that point to David. Is there such a thing as environmentally sustainable capitalism, do you think?
That's an excellent question. That's not my expertise. On a personal note, I've never understood the idea that we always must grow the economy by 3%. As a mathematician, that makes no sense asymptotically because we run out of planet. So I've become very confused by the economics that are driving our planet. But I did want to bring up a different point, which is the public are seeing a lot of these reports. The IPCC came out 2 months ago or so and made many of these points. This was the World Meteorological Organization, also an arm of the UN. And one of the points it made is about observing the planet. So the entire foundation of our conversation is that, is climate change really happening? And the answer is yes, it's extremely likely that humans are changing the planet. That's a very strong statement. And what it's based on is observation. And for example, methane in the last 2 years has shot through the roof, but we don't know where it's coming from. And so there's an emphasis in this report about observing the planet. And so we need to engage the coming generation in a real desire to act in the science and technology, et cetera, in order to observe the planet and understand it. I myself work in Antarctica on the so-called Doomsday Glacier. That's kind of the linchpin of global sea level. It looks like that glacier is unstable. We're still trying to model it and understand it, maybe not in time if it collapses. So the idea of the report is that the Secretary General stated the plan for, if you will, early warning for all. And so we should put a little bit of focus on the fact that we need to observe the planet better, because the punchline is we can't mitigate if we really don't understand where the change is happening.
Now, we are running out of time. I want to get an answer from all three of you just very, very quickly. I'll begin with Leon Simons. Leon, if it's not capitalism, if it's not sustainable capitalism, then it has to be science that is the solution. Is science the solution to this? Is there a science that could be the magic bullet?
So there is no one single magic bullet, right? So if you look at, for example, greenhouse gas emissions, it's not one source which we can just shut off. We have the whole of the planet. Everyone uses oil, fossil fuels, which emits greenhouse gases. Consume dairy of meat and dairy products, which emit methane. Rice emits methane. So we have to be, of course, clear about that. It's not one solution which can solve everything. And we will be emitting greenhouse gas for quite a while, but we should work on the solutions. And we need industry, we need people, we need science, we need science and institutions, not to ignore the crucial parts of the system, right, which are changing regionally. So we should be aware of this. For example, one aspect is these sulfur emissions, which I keep mentioning. Right. In the IPCC report, there was a big discussion about emitting these particles on purpose. And then there was a debate between Saudi Arabia and Tanzania, and then they just stopped mentioning the sulfur at all, because some countries might decide to emit sulfur on purpose and cool the planet. But I think that shouldn't be that these discussions could start. Shouldn't right. be a reason okay. to discuss the crucial aspect of what's changing, what's bringing the most rapid change regionally.
Sorry, Leon, I'm going to jump in here because we are running out of time and I want to come to David and to Andrew. David, we're talking about, like, science. Should science take the lead over governmental institutions, over private businesses? Is science the only way out of this?
The foundation of this whole climate discussion is a scientific one, and then politicians have to take action based on the science. The topic of geoengineering was just brushed on. That's an extremely important topic, very sensitive one going forward. So the science really is the key to this, because we're seeing that solar and wind energy coming down in price and becoming affordable. Where we're lacking is in carbon capture technology as we seek to go to carbon neutrality by 2040. I really think carbon capture is something we all need to focus on, because that can solve a large part of the problem. And without that, the technology, which we currently don't have, but we can get to, we are in somewhat trouble.
Sorry, David, I'm going to come to you, Andrew, in just a sec. David, carbon capture is a new term on me. It's not something I really understand. I'm sure it's not something our audience understands. Very quickly, what is it?
Carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And the question is, can you draw it back down? So we put in some 80 gigatons a year, some large volume of carbon gas, carbon dioxide. Can we withdraw it? Yes. And some small-scale projects have already demonstrated this. A recently one in Iceland involving capturing carbon through interaction with volcanic rock. People are talking about seagrass around the coastlines of the world. Right. Seagrass water, of course, sucks in carbon dioxide. So there are thoughts about how can we grab the carbon out of the atmosphere and store it. So that technology right now is very expensive. And we have to think about governments putting in policies.
Leon, I do see you. I will come to you in just a second. I want to come to Andrew. Andrew, we're talking about carbon capture, which is, like I say, a new term for me. But once again, it's science that's leading the way. That science is going to be controversial. Do you think there are these radical, almost sci-fi ideas that can change the way we are at the moment?
Well, I think we need to have discussions around them at this point. I mean, sci-fi, I don't think is an appropriate term anymore because the technology is widely available, or at least very closely attainable. So we need to make sure that organizations such as humanitarian organizations not only have a seat at the table, but have a voice that is integrated in a systematic way into these discussions and are driving these discussions. I think that's where things can go very wrong if we don't have the humanitarian voice at its substantive level within the discussions. It's more than just getting people at the table. It's understanding the governance of these discussions and the roles and the responsibilities of the different organizations and who they represent. So yes, science is a big part, but there's many different types of science. We have climate science. We have social sciences that we also need to bring more into the mix, I believe, especially when we're talking about early warning. Yes, the WMO has the Early Warning for All initiative. It's a really has great potential. However, warnings and alerts are just part of the answer. There's a big gap between warnings and alerts and actually taking action. And there's a big gap between taking action and taking action in the communities that need it the most. So we need to also integrate the social science, the governance aspects. I think that echoes what our other guests are saying as well.
So I want to thank all our guests, Leon Simons, David Holland. I want to thank all our guests, Leon Simons, David Holland, and Andrew Krucikovic. And I want to thank you as well for watching. You can see the programme again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Imran Khan, and the whole team here, bye for now.